the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, that's us. That's Bucket Strategy Investing. Back with more of said program. We're helping you to make better money moves both before and throughout retirement. That's certainly our goal right here, and we do our best to make that happen every day on the show. I'm Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, back again. This hour's strategy session. Now, we got a lot of stuff to talk about, as is our want for Tuesdays. We'll be talking first up about active versus passive money management. Mentioned this a little bit yesterday, too. We're going to tell you, first of all, what it is and why what you may have been hearing, I think, in the financial press, shockingly, may not be the advice that you need. All right, so which one is better? Should you have actively managed funds or investments, passively managed? What are they? Can a blend of both be best suited to you? Maybe. We're also going to tell you why it's important to know this stuff, giving you all the information that you need to know. That's coming up shortly right here on the program. Also joining us, I mentioned, is it's jam-packed this hour, Steve Allendorf. He'll be in studio with us here in just about 15 minutes, our loan financial planner, to talk about how the Fed's increase in rates could or may not, who knows, affect you. We're going to talk about what the prime rate is and how mortgage rates move one way or another based on the prime rate. Important information just ahead. Steve's going to tell us what we need to know. That's coming up. You got a question for the Brain Trust? Sure you do. You give us a call right now. 877-PLANNER. Lines are open. 877-752-6637. We do have, I think, every line is open right now. If you want to send us your emails, you go over to wealthed.com, our website, click on the Find Your Answer link, and we'll read your email here on the air. Professor Rick Plum, mentioned him. He's here courtesy again of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group. You do need to know, you should know by now, that you need a bucket strategy. You need one that's tailored specifically to meet your goals and to meet your needs. Professor Plum is available, as is anyone at Lucia Capital Group, any of the Brain Trust advisors, at this phone number, 800-644-1150. You can meet with an advisor, get your strategy set up and running. You know, everyone's situation is different. Everyone's retirement plan is also different, as is yours. Once again, the number to reach them off the air, 800-644-1150. And our number here in studio, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. As I said, we do have some lines open. A lot of stuff to talk about this hour. Now, some people don't even understand, Professor Plum, when I say active versus passive money management. First of all, we're going to talk about what it is, and then we're going to talk about why people should care, because they should.
Well, let's talk about what passive management first is. Passive management is following an index. In many cases, a computer-generated list of investments, whether it be stocks or bonds, and buying those specific investments. No fundamental analysis necessary. It's, you know, like the S&P 500 is the 500 largest companies in the U.S., and they break it down by size. So it's capital, what they call capital-weighted. So there's a computer out there, the Standard & Poor's, that lists the 500, the size, and says that this company, you know, I think Apple is maybe the largest one, comprises, you know, 3% or 2% or some number based on size. So it's all rated. And so they create this index. And then an index fund just goes out and tries to mimic the exact same order and the exact same percentages. Obviously, can't do exactly the same number, but tries. It's just trying to buy what that index is. The Dow Jones has the industrials, a specific set of stocks, not based on any performance criteria, not based on any fundamental analysis, just based on a specific something. So it's basically following a computer-generated list of stocks. Now, they're very efficient in that respect because the 500 biggest stocks in the U.S. don't change very often, so there's not a lot of buying and selling. The Dow Jones Industrials are about the same. They don't change very often. An index tends to be a very buy-in and hold and passive investment, and which is fine. There's nothing wrong with a passive investment as an index or something of that nature. Now, a lot of people looked at it and said, well, you know, the total stock market index, 1,000 stocks, the S&P 500, 500 stocks, that's just too broad. I want to get something a little tighter, a little more concentrated in a certain area. Rather than just having this one big broad index or something, why can't I just buy an index of, well, it used to be energy stocks that people really wanted, or pharmaceuticals, or biotechs, or some other smaller section. And so they've created smaller indexes as well. And what they've also created are something called exchange-traded funds, which basically buy a specific set. So instead of trying to pick the one pharmaceutical company that's going to do really well. You pick an index of pharmaceutical, an exchange-traded fund that invests in nothing but pharmaceuticals, and those are the ones you buy, and you've got a diversification and hold it. So indexing and passive investing is not a problem. It actually, in many respects, can work very well because the costs are very low. They're fairly tax efficient when it comes to owning it in a personal account. It doesn't create a lot of turnover buying and selling every day. But it also, it is basically you're buying the market. You're buying the 500 biggest stocks. And as we found out yesterday, half of the stocks, or more than half of the stocks,
55%.
55% of the stocks in the S&P 500 were down, and 45% of them were up. About 20% of them were up more than 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one school of thought that just says, well, I just want to own all of them. And another school of thought that says, let's see if we can apply some filters and see if we can weed out the ones that aren't going to do as well and maybe only buy 200 stocks and try to make sure that we own the stocks that do well and not the ones that drag us down. And so an active manager is somebody who's applying something other than just buying a list of stocks generated by a computer and going in and saying, okay, this one has better potential than these. Now, is he going to be right 100% of the time? Nope. Nobody's ever right 100% of the time. So it has its own set of risks, where one is that you don't do very well because the market didn't do very well. The other is that the manager didn't pick well. And so using an active management. Now, active management doesn't mean that they're buying and selling and trading every day. They could be, you know, buying and selling once or twice a year, but they're limiting the amount of ownership of a specific area to a more condensed area. The reality is the majority of your long-term return is going to come from your allocation within the different sectors rather than whether you're using active or passive management. Because even if you're using index funds, even if you're using exchange-traded funds, something passively managed, you should have some small cap, some large cap, some international, maybe even some emerging markets, and an allocation of these different types of investments, these different sectors.
Now, let me ask you, the question might be in this, are you not getting that if you just buy the S&P 500?
Well, no, the S&P 500 are all basically U.S. stocks. Now, many of them are global in nature, mm-hmm. but they still act and respond to U.S. markets the way that U.S.
stocks do. So even though you're buying the entire
index.
And
they're the big company, they're not small companies.
Right, so you're really not getting the diversification that you might think.
No,
and
you would want to have the best performing asset class has typically been small cap, but they're very volatile, and the investors in small cap don't do very well because they can't handle the heat. They get in and they get out at the wrong times. But by adding it to an overall portfolio, you can actually enhance your return and reduce your volatility because they act at different times. So the overall allocation of the sectors is as important as whether you're using active or passive investing within the sectors. And so I actually like having a little bit of both. Some active management to try to juice the return a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Some passive management, ETFs, index funds, and things of that nature. But I also want to have somebody looking at the overall. How much should I have in international? How much should I have in small cap? Small cap did not do very well last year compared to large company stocks. You think the S&P didn't do very well? It basically broke even. Small cap did worse. They were down about 4 or 5% last year. International. You know? So all these things you want to go into play. So who are you going to have manage the allocation, whether it be at the fund level, the exchange traded level, the investment level, or at the allocation level? There's multiple levels of management going on. Now, can you get away with just buying one fund and never looking at it for 30 years? Yeah, probably. Will you do as well as some other things? Only time will tell us for sure. What I have seen the problem with that, though, is people tend to get upset, not in the years where your particular index is doing well, but when your particular index isn't doing well, people get out of it and go into something that was doing well. That's the human behavior part of us. And that's what screws us up.
So what they're doing is they're upset over the fact that they didn't do well. They saw something else over there that did do well, and they start chasing yield. And we know where that's going to
bring it. Chasing return. And it rarely works in your favor. And that's why the allocation, having some over there and some over here and some over here, the allocation between the different sectors. Now, active management, passive management in the stock market, it's been argued back and forth all day long. I don't think it works as well in bonds, though, when you're talking about a bond index. The problem with bond indexes, when you're dealing with passive management, the index may have 1,000 bonds in it, but the manager can't go out and buy all those bonds. They may not even be for sale at a reasonable price for what they can get. So they use sampling, and they'll buy a little bit here and a little bit there to try to get at least as much of a mimicry, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, of the index as possible. But it's almost impossible to actually be the index. And so it's very difficult to keep up with, and you're taking on a little bit more risk. And so that's where I think active management in the bond portfolio world has done better than passive management in the bond portfolio world.
There's more to say on this. After the bottom of the hour, when we bring Professor Rick Plum back, we'll be talking about perhaps cost being an issue, and again, on some of these bonds that he's talking about, active versus passive. How do you decide? And if neither one is going to win, what do you do? As Professor Plum just says, he likes a little bit of both. All right, 877-PLANNER, our number. Coming up next, Steve Allendorf will join us, our loan financial planner. He's going to be here talking about the Fed. Oh, yeah, that's right. Remember, a few weeks ago, they raised rates. What does that mean to you? We'll tell you about it when we come back on Bucket Strategy Investing. Like a long time since I've talked to this guy, Steve Allendorf. It's been a few weeks, but you know, the holidays were here. Happy New Year to you, Steve.
You too, John.
Our loan financial planner, he's here talking to us about mortgages for a segment or so, and interest rates. We're going to get into this in just a second. Steve is here from Rancho Financial, and we thank him for joining us. You can reach him at loan, L-O-A-N, loanfinancialplanner.com, or at his phone number in his office, 888-563-1070, and he'll be there probably sometime in the next half hour. If you have any questions on any of this stuff that we talk about, you can talk to Steve directly. All right, so we've had interest. I tell you what I'm going to do, because I had a call standing by on mortgages. Let's do that. Let's
sure.
take that first, and then we'll get into some of the stuff on prime rates and Fed and all that stuff.
Got
if
it.
That's okay with you. So let's bring Joe up next. Hello, Joe.
Good morning, guys. Here's my question. I currently own a home. It's paid in full. The last I heard, my credit score is about 806, something like that. There's a potential that I might want to take a mortgage out on a second property, and I have an extra credit card that I don't seem to be using. And my curiosity was, if I canceled that credit card, would that raise my credit score at all for the sake of getting a mortgage?
Well, Joe, based on what I'm hearing from you, you don't have a mortgage debt on your primary residence. Do you have mortgage debts on any of your properties?
I don't know. I only own my own house and with no other properties, but there's a potential I might buy a second house.
Got it. And
that would be somewhat of a rental. I would be renting it to a relative is what I would be doing.
Yeah.
And I'm not too sure whether or not I want to go ahead and buy that house in full or maybe go on a mortgage. So my thinking is I have an extra credit card, and when that time comes, I want it to be prepared if I could up my credit score even more.
Well, with an 800 credit score, my guess is that you've got minimal debt. You're telling me that credit card doesn't even have a balance. It really, in your scenario, wouldn't make that much of a difference, but my recommendation is don't do anything with that credit card, because there potentially would be an inquiry to have that credit company close out that credit debt. And just as important, it won't necessarily improve your credit score, because credit scores are based on what you have as far as potential credit and how much you've used. So if you've got $50,000 of credit availability and you've got $2,000 on the credit debt, you've got a very low use to your ability to use credit. If you eliminate a credit card that may, let's say, have a $10,000 available credit limit, now you've reduced your available credit from 50 to 40,000, and your percent goes higher. So in the past, yes, it might make sense to do that. In your situation, I wouldn't worry about it and I wouldn't touch it. The key is if you have credit debt, what you want to do is not close the cards out, but lower the balance down if you have a balance less than between 50% or 30%.
It's the ratio is what you're talking about.
Correct, which is real important. So, Joe, in your scenario, I wouldn't even worry about it. Don't close it out. It will not affect you if you decide to go ahead and do that second home purchase.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, guys.
Absolutely welcome.
Thank you for the call, Joe. We do appreciate it. I guess it's changed a little since you know.
Years ago. Yeah, it
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
look better
now,
if you closed it out. But
yeah,
actually, you're much better off if you've got $70,000 of available credit on all your credit cards, and you've got a very low balance. You don't want to close out the credit cards.
See, that almost seems counterintuitive to me.
Doesn't it?
Because I think, well, now I've got the potential to use all this credit. And, you know, who's to say I'll be able to pay my mortgage after I do this?
So, exactly.
But, hey, whatever. This is how it works. All right. So now let's talk very quickly about the Fed. We saw the quarter point, 25 basis point rise in interest rates last month in December. Where does this leave mortgage holders? What does this mean?
First of all, merry flipping Christmas to all the consumers that went ahead and put money on their credit cards, because if they don't pay them off on their next billing statement and or their balances, they're going to see a higher payment than they would have a month or two ago. In most cases, with the Fed raising the short-term rate and the discount rate, it doesn't directly affect the consumers that way, but prime moves up the same amount as the increase that the Feds did. So if you have credit cards that are based on prime, you'll see a quarter point increase in your credit card interest rate, and hence an increase in your payment. The majority of equity line loans are based on prime. So although you may not have seen any change in your December billing, you probably will in your January billing, no later than your February billing. So you're going to get a quarter point increase based on what your balance is. Mm-hmm. You'll see an increase in your payment. But the other thing to be aware of is that people that have equity lines, the majority of them, got the equity lines 2006 and prior, as far as the majority of them out there, because they were plentiful and the rates were great.
Yes, unless they were closed out like mine were.
Correct. And for a lot of people, what's going to happen is it reaches that 10-year point. Most equity lines have that 10-year pay just interest. Mm-hmm. You can use it, and after that period, then it fully amortizes for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, depending on your equity line lender. So there could be a difference of $300, $500, $1,000 a month in payment going from an interest-only payment on a line of credit
to start paying the principal
to a 10, 15, or 20-year principal payout.
Yeah.
So even though the rates may remain low, if you can handle the payment, great, because you're probably not going to find a better rate out there. But I'm starting to get phone calls from borrowers that have lines of credit, and they want to merge them, not because it's a bad interest rate, it's because of the significant increase in payment.
Now, we talk about prime, that's the index right there.
I mean, that would be for the majority of the equity lines and some of the credit cards.
Exactly. All right, so what else do people know? I mean, you know, people hear, well, quarter point, there could be another one. A lot of people have these adjustable rate loans, and they start to get nervous because they say, look, if they raise it in December, and mine adjusted in November, and it's going to adjust again in November, if they start raising interest rates again in March, I'm not saying they will, but if they do, and maybe they say in June,
I know,
of a sudden come November, I'm going to have, what, an extra percentage?
The whole idea is the Fed stated really clearly that the pace of the increases, and I'm reading directly here from what I pulled off the internet, will be gradual and dependent on the quality of economic data. But they're not going to have all that economic data because the adjustable rate mortgages, and most of them, I mean, there are some that adjust monthly, mm-hmm. but most of them are annual adjustment programs. Mm-hmm. So if you have a loan that has an anniversary date in March or April or May, you're not going to feel that effect
until
that period of time. And if you have a large mortgage, $300,000, $400,000, it could mean a difference of $100, $200, $300 a month. Now, is that going to restrict a person's ability to then spend money into the economy, which is the whole reason that they raise interest rates, is to kind of, you know, protect against inflation and demand? We're not going to know that.
No, we won't
know it. For a period of time.
No, there's a lagging effect. If they don't even notice this payment until May, you know, it may be another 6-7 months before they decide that they can't afford things, and then another few months after that before it's noticed in the overall economy.
And the bottom line is, the whole reason to increase rates is to curb inflation. We didn't have inflation. This was pressure from the markets for the Feds to do something.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no inflation at all.
So the Feds did what they did. Now they got everybody off their back, and I think they're going to sit and wait. So even if you have an adjustable loan, even if it does go up, for a lot of people, adjustable rate loans are still going to be in the low 3% range with the adjustment, which is significantly lower than a current fixed rate mortgage.
You need a mortgage strategy, and this is why we have our strategists. This program's all about strategy. You can reach Steve Allidord, our loan financial planner, at loan, L-O-A-N, financialplanner.com. His website, of course, or at 888-563-1070. Steve, thanks again as always.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next week. Johnny Dean, Professor Plum returns. It's Bucket Strategy Investing. Market Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, here with you once again. If you have any questions, you give us a call. We took one during Steve Allard's segment. We can take more here. 877-PLANNER, if you have questions on anything. Could be mortgages too, but, you know, whatever it is. You have a money issue right now. You give us a call, 877-PLANNER. Emails, once again, wealthed.com. Our website. And don't forget, this afternoon, it's Tuesday, which means that once again, we have a live version of the Social Security Show with me, Johnny Dean, and this guy, Professor Rick Plum. It's every Tuesday afternoons, 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern, and it's only at wealthed.com. We got some phone calls to answer on that show. We have some emails to get to on that program. We're also going to talk about strategies surrounding Social Security. Yes. I say this at the top of every hour. Every situation is different. Well, it's certainly true in the case of Social Security. There are about, I couldn't even tell you how many different permutations or combinations of situations that there are with regard to Social Security, but it's a lot. And everybody has a different strategy. So we're going to talk about that this afternoon on the Social Security Show. Once again, 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern. It's only at wealthed.com. wealthed.com. Again, our phone number, 877-PLANNER. We got some lines open right now. If you have any money questions, 877-752-6637. Now, to kind of wrap up the whole active versus passive money management, we were talking that before Steve joined us here. The question comes up, or the statement perhaps comes up, that one is always better than the other. You know, active. And then people come up and they say passive. And I'm going to show you statistics. And I'm going to show you the actual numbers. And how this side always consistently beats the other side. But that can't possibly be true, Rick.
Well, it's not true. And it's not always. And it also depends on what type of an asset class you're looking at. Now, the indexes do work fairly efficiently and fairly well in the large company U.S. stock market area. So you can use exchange-traded funds and or index funds in those areas. I like using, as I mentioned earlier, about half and half.
As you some talk about passively managed.
Using an index and a actively managed portfolio within my large cap sector. Mm-hmm. But the larger the companies that you're dealing with, the more information that is readily available about them, the more it's harder to find that little nugget in the raw. But when you get to the smaller cap area, mid cap, when you get to international, especially emerging markets, the indexes tend not to do anywhere near as well as a good manager in those areas who can sift through the information and say, okay, this company has a much better chance of outperforming than these other companies. And so when it comes to
coughing. You okay there? Do you need a second?
I'm getting all choked up about this.
Get choked up, and I'm going to give the phone number, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We've coerced you. Even you've got this bronchial thing going on here.
Yeah, it was just one of those.
It's one of those things. That's the way
New Year's things that you get.
Yes, all right. So,
but it's a matter of picking and choosing the fights you want to deal with. Is active always best? Is passive always best? No, it's not. Does active tend to outperform in certain areas? Yes. Does passive tend to do fairly well in certain areas? Sure. And so by creating an appropriate allocation of the different types of management, you can potentially create a better, more efficient portfolio. But the overall thing still goes back to who's looking at the allocation. Who's picking how much small cap, international, large cap, growth, value. All these things come into play. And I was just recently looking at a chart that shows the nine basic sectors of the stock market, and from year to year the performance, the best, they're ranked from best to worst. And nobody continues all the time. And so even the best performing classes, whether you're arguing over active or passive management within a certain class, it's not going to perform the best year in and year out. So it's still going back to the allocation to determine what your long-term rate of return is. And again, back what we talked about earlier, how you behave and react and manage your portfolio. Unfortunately, we are our own worst enemies. We tend to do things at the wrong time and the wrong reason. And when we don't get the returns that we think we should, because our index didn't beat their index or didn't beat their. And when you're talking to somebody at a party or something, they're only telling you about their winners. They are not telling you about what they lost.
Get out. Is that really true?
It really is
true. The people who are standing around at the barbecue telling us just, hey, oh, listen to this. I took this from the ground floor and look where it went. Yeah. That's all they're telling us about? I can't believe that somebody would be dishonest like that.
So you have to look at it from a true perspective and try to take emotion out of it. And like we talked about before, active, passive, they both can work. Now, in a momentum-driven market where everything is just on fire, which we haven't seen lately, passive management does actually do a fairly good job. In a non-momentum market, something like what we've been seeing lately, active management can and has shown to do better than indexing. And so what's going to happen for the next year, the next month? I don't know which one's going to do better. That's why I like going back to that half and half, the 50-50 market. A little bit of indexing, a little bit of active management, and I can't be 100% wrong that way.
That's right. You'd rather be 50% right than 100% wrong.
And as long as I have a decent allocation, and I still believe in a global allocation, and I continue to fund, and I have a long-term time horizon for these types of assets, I'm gonna be fine.
877-PLANNER, our number. We're going to take some calls. We got some people on hold. We still have a line or two open, though. 877-752-6637. Call with your money questions. We've got your money answers standing by with Professor Rick Plum. Let's go next to Bruce in Minneapolis with a question. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'll try to make this quick. I am currently 63. I'll be 66 in November of 2018. At that time, my wife will have turned 63, and I'm thinking of taking her spousal benefit, and I would wait until age 70 to take my full benefit, the best benefit when I turn 70. She would then be taking her benefits at age 63. And I believe I can do that with the new plans or the new legislation, and I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
You okay, Rick?
I'm
getting them all choked up with these questions here, Bruce.
I'm sorry about that, Bruce. No, you can. The new rules that went into place last November took away the restricted application for anybody who was not 62 years of age or older by the end of 2015. You are 62 years or older at the end of 2015, so you still have the ability to do a restricted application, which means that as long as your wife is receiving her benefit, you can take a spousal benefit from her once you get to full retirement age and leave your own benefit to grow until age 70. And if you believe that either you or your wife is going to live, 60, into their 80s or mid 80s or longer, then that makes a lot of sense. And so you have, you've got a very good strategy in place if you believe that you're going to live a long time, or at least one of you will live a long time.
Would it be better to have her have us just both wait until we're 70?
I think now you're betting that both of you live well into your 80s. And no, it wouldn't be better in that respect. I think that it's hard to overcome that early money and have the bet that both of you will live to basically 89 or 88, 89, 90 or later. I play odds. I'm looking at it. The odds of both of you having longer than normal life expectancies is less likely than the odds of one of you having a longer than normal life expectancy.
What are your thoughts on that, Bruce, as far as longevity for both of you?
Well, I think I agree with both of you to do the first idea here, because that would give me some extra cash waiting until I turn 70, and so I think that'd be a good way to do it for sure.
Right, and you if you wanted to wait a little bit longer so your wife's benefit's a little larger, you wait until just before you turn 66 for her to turn hers on, and then she'll be 63-ish instead of starting it at 62, and she'll get a little bit bigger benefit than what she would have if she started earlier.
Yeah, exactly, because when I turn 60, I have to be 66 to do this. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And I won't be 66 till she turns 63, so this is perfect.
Okay, yeah, and so you get some money coming in, she's got her benefit, and then you get not half of what she's actually receiving, but half of what her full retirement age benefit would have been if she had waited, because the spousal benefit is based on her full retirement age benefit.
Okay. Even if she's 63, I'm still getting half of her benefit if she at 66.
Yep.
Wonderful.
Yep.
Well, this is great. I appreciate the advice, guys.
Thank you for the call, Bruce. We appreciate the question. Yeah. In order, what you have to remember, if you're waiting to take a benefit, there's a break-even age, because you're giving up, in some cases, 4 years of checks.
Well, and if she's giving up and he's giving up, they're giving up quite a bit of money early for her to wait until age 70 to start her benefit. I just think that the odds of both of them, unless they've just got the most incredible longevity on both sides,
it does
which they
happen.
May, and we can look at that. The other way would do for him to wait till 70, but she does not have the ability to do a restricted application. So she can't take half of his and wait until 70 on her own.
Yeah.
Because she's under 62 as of the end of 2015.
Yeah, quite a bit, actually, under age 62. Okay, there's your answer. Simone in Indio, don't go away. With just a couple of minutes here, I want to make sure you get your question in plenty of, with plenty of time. So questions on G-Funds coming up, and it looks like we have two lines open, or just one. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, it is Bucket Strategy Investing. The good version. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. And hey, there's another hour coming up. So if you can't get enough of us for this hour, you're not even halfway done yet. So join us next hour as well on most of these same radio and television stations. Again, our number, 877-PLANNER. Tom and Henderson, give us a call back. I know you had a Social Security question, and we lost a couple of callers there. But let's get next to Simone in Indio, California. Simone, thanks for hanging on. How can we help you today?
Good morning. I moved all my 401 money into the G Fund, and I'm wondering if that was a smart move. I'm just a few years away from retirement.
When did you do this? A couple days ago?
Maybe a couple weeks ago.
Well, as the market has turned out, it was a great idea. What you need to do now is write a book on how you time the market, and so you missed out on the most recent downturn in late December and the first couple days of trading this year. In hindsight, it's turned out to be a very good move. Now the question is, why did you do it, and should you stay in the G Fund going forward? The G Fund, for those that are out there listening, is a guaranteed government securities fund. It does not go down in value. It earns 1.5-2% right now. It's an interest-bearing account. It's part of the federal government's thrift savings plan. It's one of the five basic choices in their plan, and it's the most secure, most safe, lowest potential return, but no risk type of an investment. And so by moving into it a couple of weeks ago, Simone has missed out on the market performance over the last couple of weeks. Now, to her benefit, the market performance has stunk. It's gone way down in the last couple of days, last couple of weeks. And so she's missed out on that. Now the question is, what should you do with the rest of the money? Now is the time. You're going to retire in a little bit here, did I hear?
Probably a few years.
Okay. So what you want to do is take a look at what you want this money to do for you. Now, the new money that you're contributing out of your paycheck every week, every 2 weeks, whatever it is, that should still be going into the more volatile areas of the common stock, the small cap stock, the international stock, to take advantage of these ups and downs. But I don't have a problem with moving it over to the safe side now. Now let's create a strategy.
Well, the reason I did it is because I have other money in the market, and I'm feeling like maybe I'm too much in the market. Maybe I should have something that's really safe.
Okay, so the idea is to take a look at the overall investment picture. When you retire, you're going to have this TSP money and these other funds. Total portfolio of how much money is the total portfolio?
Probably about six.
600,000, okay. And so you're going to want to take some money out of these funds when you retire to supplement your Social Security and your federal employee retirement, right?
Right.
So we need to back into how much money should you have in the G Fund. And it may be that you keep it right where it is, because this is a very good, in your situation, what we call bucket number one, the money we're going to draw down in the early part of retirement, because it's a fairly good, safe account that has a reasonable, better than bank account money interest rate. So you need to sit back, take a strategic look at things and say, okay, I need to have about $200,000 in bucket number one. I should have about $200,000 in bucket number two. And I can afford to have these are made up numbers, by the way, $200,000 of my overall portfolio in equities, in stocks, in volatile areas to let it grow, because I'm not going to touch that money until I'm 80 years old. And so let's step back and identify where the money should be. But from what you're telling me, putting this money in the G fund is probably a good step.
Okay. Do you recommend like a allocation percentage?
I recommend tailoring it to your to your income needs. Let's look at what you're going to need from an income source when you retire, and back into the allocation designed around what you need, not, you know, take your age minus 100 or whatever the case may be. Let's take a look at what you need. Do you need $1,000 a month from the portfolio? $2,000 a month from the portfolio? Will you need some other number? Will you need $3,000 a month for a little while until the house is paid off? Then you'll only need $1,000. Let's design your portfolio around what you need from an income standpoint over your retirement. And then you know, okay, I know how much money I need to have in the G type of fund, a bucket number one. I know how much money. I have a reason for putting the money here. I know how much money I can take at, you know, put at risk. I understand why I'm investing. And now you have a strategy to meet your goals.
Okay, I got some homework to do.
Okay, and we can refer you to people that can help you with that homework.
Tell you what, if you want to hang on for a second, Simone, I can have Professor Plum talk to you more about this, as we do on occasion. So hold on if you have some more questions. I say this a lot, but it's a good opportunity for Simone to do some planning. She got lucky with the timing, I guess.
Very good. I mean, and when you're a couple years ahead of retirement, that's when you want to start pulling back the aggressiveness of your overall portfolio. It sounds like she's looking forward a couple years saying, I want to be able to rely on this portfolio to drive an income or to drive a cash flow, and I don't want to watch it go down. And so, at least not all of it. And so we want to put some money into a safer area so that no matter what happens in the market between now and when she wants to retire, she can still retire, and she has this source of capital to live off of for the next 10 or 15 years while the market does whatever it does.
Yeah, this is a dilemma facing a lot of people, and Simone's been thinking about this, which is a good idea. But as they approach retirement, they're looking at a lot. They may have a large percentage of their assets. What they look at is exposed to risk,
and it is exposed to risk if it's anywhere near the market. There is no safe market investment.
So it becomes a question. Well, now I don't want to pull everything out. Because I still got a few years to go, and I don't want to miss out on anything, but how much do I take out? How much do I make safe? And I think this is where good advice comes in.
Right, and so she's, how much should she have in a safe environment? Well, that is not just an allocation question. It's a lifestyle question. What do you need to run your life? If you need $2,000 a month, maybe you put $150,000, $200,000 in the G fund, and you put another $200,000 in a balanced portfolio, and you put the other $200,000 or so into the growth portfolio. Because even if the growth portfolio goes down, you got 15 or so years worth of money in these other areas. But if the market does well, you at least have money in the market to take advantage of what the market is going to give you, all the while being protected from what the market can take away from you. So that's exactly what she needs to do. It's not an allocation question by, oh, you should be a 60-40. You're 60 years old.
You're nuts.
Let's look at what you need. You're going to have your federal employee retirement, whether it's CSRS or FERS, I don't know yet. You're going to potentially have some Social Security, maybe some other incomes from other sources. What do you need this portfolio to do for you? And identify that portfolio's uses.
Great answer, great questions. There's more coming up. If you need the Brain Trust off the air, talk to Professor Rick Plum or any of the advisors from Lucia Capital Group at their off-air number, 800-644-1150. Again, 800-644-1150. Our number on the air, 877-PLANNER. There's more coming up. Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.